Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For over 40 years, Dee Brown's bestseller, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, has been considered the best general history of the Western Indian Wars, and at the time of its publication, broke new ground for its depiction of the conflict from the indigenous people's perspective. But my guest today, in tackling this same subject matter, says Brown's approach was as one-sided as early historians, which told this complex story as America's inevitable destiny to conquer the West. Historian Peter Cousins looked for a balanced approach that noted the divides in opinions and Indian policies within government, within the army itself, and the divides between tribal members over white encroachment on their lands. The result is the first major book since Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee to tackle the whole of the Western Indian Wars. The Earth is Weeping, the epic story of the Indian Wars for the American West, is published by Knopf. Peter Cousins is a former decorated Foreign Service officer and the author and editor of 16 acclaimed books on the American Civil War and the Indian Wars of the American West, including a five-volume set of first-hand accounts of the various Western conflicts titled Eyewitnesses to the Indian Wars. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Peter Cousins, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, in writing this account of the Western Indian Wars, you acknowledge, in fact, at the beginning of the book, you're working in the footsteps of Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. You write that you work to really give a more balanced impression compared to Brown, and of course to the previous generation writers' accounts of the Western Wars, which really looked at it from the white perspective, or sort of the expansion of America viewpoint. Can you tell us how you try to get this sort of balanced look at these wars over 40 years in the American West?
I relied to the greatest extent possible on primary sources, both Indian primary sources and, of course, those of white participants. And surprisingly, to me, it was really as easy to obtain good, reliable Indian sources as it was white. And many of these had actually become available subsequent to Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And so I was able to construct the story by telling the story from the point of view of all participants and letting the narrative and the theses, in a way, develop from their accounts.
Now, when we think of the Indian Wars of the American West and the 19th century, I think from a 21st century perspective, it's hard to get that balanced impression, although there's this sort of dichotomy, because if we had left those tribes alone, America would not be, the United States would not be the country it is today, and it was probably inevitable that these were going to happen. But at the same time, if we look at these conflicts through a 21st century lens, we can't help but look at it one-sided, to my viewpoint. How do you view it?
Well, from a 21st century perspective, of course, that's true, but the expansion was inevitable. A nation of 75 million, bursting with energy after the Civil War. And these tribes, some of the more famous tribes, like the Cheyenne, for instance, really at that time didn't number more than, say, 3,000 warriors. But they effectively called their homeland an area the equivalent of an entire state today. And, of course, that was just not tenable. I mean, that lifestyle was not tenable. And I think the governments, and this is something I try to stress when I talk about it, I think the government's policy for the time was enlightened. That is to say, gather the Indians on reservations and try to Christianize and civilize them in the parlance of the day. And not outright, there was no policy of extermination, nor was that ever contemplated. So I think, again, through the lens of the time, I think, although the implementation was sadly lacking for a number of reasons, I think the overall government intent was the best it could be at that time.
Now, one of the things you write in writing about the first-person accounts, this is one of the things we always think of it as sort of a government policy as we look back in hindsight, that it was about sort of a measured expansion where we were concerned about Indian rights, but really in the implementation, they weren't. But one of the things you said, one of the greatest primary sources you had, was that after any conflict between the United States armed forces and these Western tribes, there'd be a congressional investigation.
Exactly. And oftentimes, I mean, it was not unusual for Congress to call on Indian participants to actually come east and testify and get their point of view across, or send people to the field to investigate and obtain Indian testimony. So there is great concern. And there was a real dichotomy, too, obviously, between the way Westerners often felt. You know, when you did see exterminationist sentiment, it was raised by Western settlers, and not by the government, not by people, obviously, east of the Mississippi who could look at this a little more dispassionately.
Now, one of the big differences between how the U.S. fought the Indian Wars and how Indians fought the Indian Wars were that the Indians fought the Indian Wars like Indians fought, and the United States fought it the way we're used to as a European power or a European background. He says there's a remarkable moment at the very beginning of the Civil War when the West, the army forces, basically depopulated. He said there was a brief moment for tribes like the Kiowa and Comanche in the southwest part of the United States here on our area in the northern plains, where they really could have maybe made a big change in what the next couple decades would look like, and they missed their chance.
That's true. They did. I mean, I think they certainly were aware that the army was pulling out, and they didn't entirely understand it. Some attributed to the fact that they had to a belief that they had actually won, and that the army was gone, and hence the whites would no longer be coming. But part of the problem stemmed from the Indian nature of warfare. Indians, when they fought very loosely. It was a warrior culture, and chiefs exercised authority at the discretion of the men who followed them. And so it was very difficult for tribes to unite in any kind of an effort against the whites. And not only that, tribes were torn between peace and war, you know, within themselves. And all during this era, and all through the Indian Wars, intertribal warfare continued. We have to remember that these tribes, even before the whites showed up, they were fighting one another constantly because these were warrior cultures, and that was the nature of the tribes to fight one another for war honors or for land. So a combination of causes prevented the Indians from really seizing this opportunity. I think it really wasn't. There was an opportunity for a few months there. Between when the regular army left and Western volunteers were recruited and took post.
Now, one of the things you do is you utilize these incredible volumes of eyewitness accounts that you've written, a five-volume set of firsthand accounts of say, the Pacific Indian Wars, like the Modoc and the Nez Perce, the Northern Plains, which was, of course, the Lakota conflicts, the Southwest with the Apaches, and also one just on what conditions were like for the cavalry and the army fighting in the West. How important were these to writing this book?
Oh, they were very important. I mean, those volumes that you refer to, Eyewitnesses to the Indian Wars, I tried to bring together the most representative and also some of the most obscure primary sources on the conflicts. And I must confess that those five volumes were eyewitness accounts from the perspective of the military. So what was an original challenge in writing The Earth is Weeping is I found myself, you know, confronting obviously the need and having the desire to go as deeply as possible in Indian sources, which I hadn't done before. And again, I was so pleasantly surprised at the volume of Indian material, original Indian source material. Was wonderful, and again, enabled me to bring balance to the book. And when I took on the topic, I wasn't sure the sources would be there, but they indeed are.
Now, one of the things you try to do is outline the internal divisions. We know there was internal divisions among military forces. You had many of the top leaders were sympathetic to their adversaries in the tasks they had to do. They looked at what their orders were, and they recognized, well, if I were on the other side, I would fight too. But you also divine some of the internal divisions between a lot of the Native American tribes as they're seeing this encroachment from Europeans, either settlers, the railroads, or prospectors. in various cases, or the military itself.
Right, and those divisions arose from a number of factors. The government did a very good job at discouraging resistance by bringing, on numerous occasions, select chiefs to Washington, D.C., to overawe them, so to speak, with the power of the whites. And these chiefs would come back to their tribes and tell of seeing, you know, single buildings that housed more people than that were their entire tribe, and of the vast numbers and strengths of the whites. And oftentimes these Indians became leaders of the peace factions, realizing the futility of resistance, and that it would mean potentially a physical extermination of their people. And other chiefs did not have that long view. Did not go to East Washington, but nonetheless did see that it was, in a sense, futile to fight, and that inevitably they would have to adjust and accommodate in order to survive. And these intertribal rivalries were violent at times and extreme. In fact, one very prominent Kiowa peace chief was poisoned by strychnine by his chief opponent, leader of the war faction. So these factions did exist in every tribe that is famous for having fought the whites. In fact, the only tribes that ever had anything approaching unanimity or unity were those tribes, ironically, that decided to cast their fate with the whites. Tribes like the Shoshone and the Crow and the Pawnee, who sort of adopted the old adage that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And these tribes, interestingly, maintained unity throughout the era in siding with the whites.
It's interesting you actually describe an incident where the Pawnees are fighting the Lakota. And you mentioned this earlier, where, especially the Lakota. Lakota, when they weren't fighting the U.S. military, they were pushing west against the Crow. Now, some of that was sort of the unassigned tribal lands where they kind of considered theirs. That would be the eastern part of Wyoming and eastern Montana.
Right.
And they would fight the Crows. Another group of the Lakota were fighting the Pawnee in northwest Nebraska, what's now northwest Nebraska. And it's interesting that how the government treated the Pawnee, because there, after the Lakota fought them in a major battle and sort of decimated a couple of bands, instead of rewarding them for their loyalty and protecting the railroad as it moved west, they shipped them off to Oklahoma here to a reservation in Indian Territory.
That, to me, was one of their occasions when the government really stumbled, and that, to me, is one that I found as I was writing the account. I found myself disgusted with the actions of the government. The Pawnee certainly deserved better than to be pulled off their tribal homelands. Indeed, you alluded to the railroad, you know, and this is something that's, for those who watched Hell on Wheels like I did, you'd never gain an appreciation for the role that the Pawnee played in protecting the railroad. There was a battalion of Pawnee equipped as soldiers, because the army had proven incompetent in trying to stop the Lakota and Cheyenne raiding on the railroad. And I think if it hadn't been for the Pawnee, probably would have taken another year to complete the Union Pacific, and might have added a year or two of seasons to Hell on Wheels.
And you mentioned Kicking Bird, the Kiowa chief. I also found something really interesting about him. There was an uprising with the Comanche and the Kiowa in the Red River country here in Oklahoma. And eventually they were brought back to the reservation. And the government forced here Kicking Bird, who was the peace chief among them, to choose the war leaders to go back east to Florida to serve time in a penitentiary or military prison. And that totally undercut any sort of relationship he could have gained in gaining the trust of the people. The United States was really ham-handed in a lot of the ways they treated the native populations.
They were. I mean, there was an enormous, even with the best intentions, there was an enormous cultural gap that few ever bridged fully or even even partially. And you know, I don't fully understand why the government threw this task on Kicking Bird's shoulders, except that maybe they thought they were doing him a favor by allowing him to eliminate his rivals in the war faction. I don't know, but it certainly was a stupid task to throw upon him.
Yeah, and of course he was poisoned.
Life, yeah.
He was poisoned probably by some of the enemies within his tribe.
Exactly, yeah, that was tragic.
My guest today is historian and former U.S. Foreign Service officer Peter Cousins. His new book is published by Knopf. It's the first major complete history of the Indian Wars written since Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. The Earth is Weeping, the epic story of the Indian Wars for the American West. And it does cover a lot of the same ground, but in a more balanced way. And one of the things I found was really interesting was you were talking about how the Pawnee filled the role because the Army was pretty incompetent in protecting the railroad. That shows up time and time again in these conflicts where it's just a matter of getting at really wars of attrition in which the Native Americans were looking at the Army as sort of not all that impressive a foe for a long time but it was that sort of keep on warring war of attrition that sort of wore these tribes down.
Exactly, and that plus the fact, and this I think may surprise readers, nearly every victory that the Army attained, particularly in the early years of the Indian Wars, they did so by virtue of the presence of Indian auxiliaries and scouts. In fact, the Apache Wars were won, you know, the wars against Geronimo and other Apache leaders were only won by pitting Apache against Apache. And no sensible Army leader would ever have thought of fighting the Indians without having Indian auxiliaries of his own. A good example is the Battle of the Rosebud, which was a precursor to the Little Bighorn. General George Crook had several hundred Crow and Shoshone auxiliaries, and they formed a buffer initially between him and the attacking Lakota and Cheyenne. And had it not been for their presence, I mean, he may have been swept from the field. So it's time and time and again in the presence of these Indian auxiliaries made the Army's task far easier and made resistance that much more difficult for those portions of tribes that chose to resist. There was an interesting incident in one battle where Cheyenne chief, you know, called out as his people were being shot down, saying, you know, look, we can fight the soldiers, but we can't fight the Indians too, you know, to paraphrase it. And that was pretty much summarized the situation.
One of the things you do in the book is you describe what conditions were like for the military in the West. And the pay was bad. The rations horrible. The officers were, if they were competent, they were tyrants. And most of the time, about half the time, they were incompetent. And a lot of the people who joined the Army end up deserting. You know, some people used them as ways to get to the gold fields and get to the West. The American Army in the West was not very good.
No, it's putting it mildly. I think it was probably the poorest the Army's ever been in our country's history. There are regiments that recorded something in the neighborhood of 80% desertion rates over time. And it got to the point where the Army was, you know, during the Civil War, of course, you deserted and you faced the possibility of a death sentence. In the West, the Army was more interested in saving equipment than it was in bringing in deserters. It was a very poor military, very poor morale. And there were just enough exceptions among the officer corps, people like Randall McKenzie or Nels Miles, just enough, combined with the eventual weight of numbers, as you mentioned, in the, you know, the war with attrition, for the Army to prevail, and again, the presence of Indian allies and auxiliaries. But overall, it was a very poor institution at that time, and the officers felt unappreciated by those in the East, and alcoholism was prevalent, and a lot of these guys, you know, found themselves dropped 2, 3, 4 grades in rank after the Civil War, as the Army contracted dramatically from 2 million to, at one point, as few as 25,000 men. And that certainly didn't help morale either.
You also mentioned Randall McKenzie, who was a cavalry officer in Well, in our neck of the woods, southwestern Oklahoma, he fought against the Kiowas and the Comanches. And to me, it was obviously from the account that you admired him, because one of the things he did was he took the time to learn how to fight his adversaries. He had a lot of respect for them, and eventually, at the end, you know, his implacable foe was Quanah Parker. They befriended one another, and he helped teach Quanah Parker how to negotiate the white man's world once Parker finally came in with his group of Comanches to Fort Sill.
Exactly, and he that of course, the story is told so well in Sam Gwynne's Empire of the Summer Moon, and there are others like him, Nelson Miles, who was probably the most nakedly ambitious officer in the United States Army, would do stop at nothing to gain promotion. When it came to the Indians, he was extraordinarily just, and in fact, actually, despite his ambition, put his career on the line at one point when he felt that the Nez Perce Indians had been dealt unjustly by the government and being shipped off to the to Oklahoma, to Indian territory. So Mackenzie, you know, he was not unique. It was quite laudable, but interestingly, not unique in the sense that we treat our defeated foes with greater sense of justice than maybe even the government intended.
Mm. Now, one of the things you write in the book is, you know, you walked the ground of many of these battle sites and where the tribes made their villages. What did you learn from spending time on the ground? I know you spent time in western Oklahoma, the site of the Ouachita battlefield where Custer's 7th Cavalry attacked Black Kettle's winter village. Fort Supply up in the northwest, that was their headquarters. And then later out in the Palo Duro country. What did you learn from being on the ground?
I learned a great deal. A lot of it is intangible. One of the great benefits of walking the western battlefields, as I say, Indian War battlefields as opposed to Civil War battlefields, is that most of them are remarkably pristine. And I'm speaking of battlefields as far-flung as the lava beds of Northern California where the Modoc War was fought, and then again down to your neck of the woods like Palo Duro Canyon and elsewhere. A lot of these sites are either on private ranch land, and of course one has to obtain permission to get onto the sites, or are state parks, and they really, or public land, and they exist in nearly, if not absolutely pristine condition. In fact, you can oftentimes still see emplacements that were thrown up during the course of the fighting and other evidence of the conflict. And that enables you to, again, get a better picture in your mind of what sources, also to judge what primary sources are most credible. By knowing the ground, you can give the lie to some sources often that just don't line up with what you've actually seen in terms of the, you know, the terrain and so forth. And again, part of it's intangible. It gives you a flavor for the conflict that I hope emerges in the course of my description of these actions.
Now, you've spent a lot of time writing about the Civil War, who, in many of the cases, the military leaders in the Indian Wars were the same people you're writing about in the Civil War. Of course, all the eyewitnesses, firsthand accounts. What was most surprising as you put this book together about the story of these Western Indian Wars?
Well, I think this era has been more deeply shrouded in myth than any other period of our history, and I found that there were three most egregious and commonly held myths that I found coming dispelled in the course of my writing were, one, that the army was hell-bent on killing Indians, two, that the government policy was exterminationist, and three, that the tribes maintained some kind of unity in combating the whites. Those are three of the things that most surprised me. And I guess fourth would be the sympathy that the army had, generally speaking, toward the Indians that they were charged with fighting. I found the attitude of most of the general officers, you know, with some exceptions, to be refreshing, quite frankly. And I had not expected that at all.
You mentioned that third point of how deep the divisions were within the tribes between those who fought and who wanted to make peace with the whites. And we think of the great Lakota Nation. You still write, says, you know, that for every Lakota that clung to the nomadic ways, probably there were 2 to 3 that moved into the reservations.
That's very true. And in fact, the two largest, there were 7 tribes that constituted the Lakota Nation, which was the largest Indian population on the Northern Plains. And the two most populous tribes were the Brule and the Oglala, and the majority of them were settled on reservations by 1870. So really, by the time of the Little Bighorn, the great majority of the Lakota were on reservations, and Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, the iconic leaders of the Lakota, come to mind to us, actually commanded the allegiance of a relatively small number of the Lakota. It just so happened that concurrently with the Little Bighorn, the reservation Lakota decided to stream off the reservation en masse to kind of enjoy one last taste of the old way of life, and that's when Custer rode into the middle of them.
Who was, as you were writing about all these figures, who perhaps was the most interesting to you to write about, that was somewhat new to you, that you saw a new side of perhaps their, who they were, that you hadn't seen before? Was there?
There were several, and no one, very few characters came out, in black and white. There were admirable qualities and lamentable qualities to all of them. In terms of people that I really came to appreciate greatly in the book, I have to rank Sitting Bull very high on that list. He really came to intrigue me and take hold of me in the course of the book. Having many more layers to him than I had expected.
In what ways?
And in the sense that he, he not simply was fighting to preserve the old way of life, but he really developed a pretty subtle understanding of the whites' motivations and the white way of life, and there was a real sense of honor about him, a code of honor that I came to admire greatly.
Peter Cousins, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate it.
Historian and former U.S. Foreign Service officer Peter Cousins speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The Earth is Weeping, The Epic Story of the Indian Wars for the American West. It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.